This is Conversations on KUAC-FM. I'm Susan McInnes. This summer, Patrick O'Rourke leaves the University of Alaska Fairbanks after a decade as its chancellor and over 20 years' work in Bethel, Anchorage, and Fairbanks for the University of Alaska. In the next hour, I'll ask him to reflect on his tenure, the university's growth and changes, and the state of education in Alaska and in the nation. Stay with us for a conversation with outgoing Chancellor Pat O'Rourke. Pat, welcome to Conversations. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Susan. Glad to be here.
My first question is one about Alaska itself and providing education. We tend to think that Alaska is unique, and in some ways we're justified. Geography, climate, diverse population, diversity of culture, the boons and very peculiar problems we run into economically. Does the uniqueness of the state come out in its education? Do you think as chancellor of a university you are dealing with a unique educational demand?
As chancellor of the University of Alaska Fairbanks,
sure.
Not of a university.
Right.
In many ways, we have a lot of unique features, but sometimes I guess I feel after 27 years in the state, Alaska sometimes continues to view itself as being the only unique place in the world, and that sometimes is a very, very parochial attitude that it winds up taking. But some of the uniquenesses, I guess, that I would reflect on are seven distinct ethnic cultures that are indigenous to this state. A lot of people just think of Alaska Native people, and they don't think in terms of Tlingits and Haidas, Tsimsheans, Inupiats, Aleuts, Yupiks, and Athabascans as distinct cultural groups. And so when you look at it from those seven distinct groups, I think you find a richness that you're not going to find in a lot of states throughout this country. I think that puts a lot of demands on educational and social systems as they try to address these different peoples across this immense geography, and I suppose that's the other unique element of it. I mean, our state runs all the way from Chicago to Seattle, and when you stretch it out, accessible only by plane or river in many areas of the state. Yet, you know, I remember Bill Egan talking about rural Alaska as the glue that holds the state together, because Anchorage and Fairbanks and South and Juneau, to a large extent, are very transient-type communities that come and go, but it's rural Alaska that really stays very, very permanent in a way and continues to provide that type of glue. Other unique elements in terms of education itself, I suppose the fact that we have committed in Alaska to delivering educational services to some very, very small places in the state. And I guess I would talk about both elementary and secondary as well as higher education. But the Molly Hooch case in the early 70s, which set the tone for village schools, which up until that point we saw children being brought at a very tender age away from their villages to boarding schools, very destructive to the family. We're now back trying to provide educational processes within the villages. I'm not sure that we're overly successful at that at the present time, but at least we're making that commitment. In the post-secondary sector, a year or two ago, I added up the number of places where the University of Alaska system had delivered credit courses in a single year, and I found that they had delivered at least one course in 188 separate villages, towns or cities in the state of Alaska, and I think we have something like 226 with a population of 25 or more. So not too many places with a population of 25 or more did not have at least one course. That's a tremendous commitment to accessibility within our state, and I've never seen anything else like it in the Union. And so to that extent, I guess there's another unique feature.
Mm-hmm. What brought you from the far east coast to literally the far west coast of the nation?
Well, I came in 1964, and I came directly from New York. I was born in New York City, raised on Long Island. I wanted something very, very different than what I had experienced in New York, and so I explored Alaska and Hawaii, found an interesting opportunity in Bethel, Alaska, took it, and went out there in 1964, and I suppose I went with no particular preconceived notions other than this was something I wanted to do at that point in time, and before I knew it, 1 year led to the next, and here I am 27 years later, stepping down as Chancellor of UAF.
Right. We are talking today on Conversations with outgoing Chancellor for the University of Alaska Fairbanks, Patrick O'Rourke. You were in Bethel, came down to Fairbanks, and then returned to Bethel to found the University of Alaska Fairbanks right. at Bethel. Was that a great challenge, or was that a natural progression from the work and thinking in your mind?
The establishment of the campus there?
Yes.
I suppose it was a fantastic opportunity, perhaps more even than a great challenge. I was here in 1972 working on campus when the legislature provided some initial funding to establish a campus in Bethel. And I guess I felt that if I could make post-secondary education work in southwestern Alaska, which is a place that it's very difficult in some ways to make things work. I mean, even the most basic things like fooling with your car or so seem to take 25% more time than they'll take any place else because you're looking for parts or unable to get them and things have to be shipped in all the time. But I guess I felt that if I could make post-secondary education work in southwestern Alaska, I could make it work anywhere in the world, and to that extent it represented a tremendous opportunity. It was the university's first commitment to a campus off the road system. They had established off the road or high or marine highway system. We did have a couple of campuses in southeastern Alaska and then a couple where we had road system access. It was the first campus that served predominantly an Alaska Native indigenous population. It was the first campus that you could only fly into. And so to that extent, I think it represented, like I said, a great opportunity and perhaps a test for the university as to whether or not it could be successful in delivering post-secondary education to Alaska Native people in other areas of the state.
And in retrospect, do you think it has been a successful experiment? That was followed by four other campuses.
Yes. Bethel led to Nome, which led to Kotzebue, which led to special arrangement with the North Slope Borough, which led to Dillingham, which led to other activities in interior Alaska and out on the chain. And I guess I look back on it and say it was a successful experience. We are providing a cadre of educated and trained people to that area of the state that I don't in much higher numbers than I think they would have otherwise had we not been there.
I want to talk about money for a couple of minutes because it's money has certainly changed a great deal since 1985-6 when
still green.
Still green. Yeah, it's true, but there's not so much of it.
Ah.
The pivotal
that part's
question.
Changed.
The university suffered major losses in 86, 87, 88.
Right.
Something like 20% of its budget was slashed away, which seems mm-hmm. like a very nearly a left or a right leg. Do you see that as the greatest crisis in the university's life since you have been here? Or would greater crises be non-financial?
Wow. That was a tough one, all right. Of course, we had a period of time in this state, I guess, starting in about 75 to 79, I think, where we were going through presidents like we had never seen before. We also, in that period of time, had a crash of our financial systems so that we were unable to be as accountable for our funds as we might have been. This is the entire system. I'm not talking of just UAF here as crisis periods, but probably I guess those budget reductions in the mid-80s, mid to late 80s, were some of the most severe ones that we had seen in higher education up until that point. Interestingly enough, as I look around the country today, 6 out of 10 states are having major financial problems that are affecting their higher education systems. That's 60% of all of the states. Some of these percentages look like they're going to outdistance the percentages that we dealt with at that time, but they were severe back then.
Do you think, I was just going to ask, and maybe this is the time to ask it, do you think good has come of the cutbacks? They made the university leaner and meaner in any way?
Well, I, to some extent, find this notion that virtually every administration, whether it's in state government or a new organization or a new institution, comes in with this view of being leaner and meaner equals improved services, to be a bit of a euphemism, and I'm not sure it always is there. I think it is reasonable to believe that institutions every 5 or 6 years probably need to tighten up and pick up any slack that might have crept into the system over that period of time. I think we did that in a very, very severe way in the 86, 87, 88 time period. But we didn't do just that. We went beyond that. We did eliminate programs. They were programs that benefited some people throughout the state. Maybe they didn't benefit the greatest numbers of people, but they did provide services. Those are gone. There are a lot fewer classes being offered today. I'm not sure that we are as able to respond to community needs and desires as we were in 1987. So while we are saving money, clearly I don't think we're providing the same level of service that we did prior to 1987.
Can this university, and I suppose I'm asking for the whole system again, can this university system use numbers as criteria to support programs? The number of graduating students, the number of students in a class?
Only partially. It depends on the philosophic commitments that surround the establishment of the university and its mission. If we are committed to delivering educational services to people in rural areas of the state, then you better throw the numbers out the window because they won't make any sense. It's very expensive to deliver to rural Alaska. What's the trade-off in terms of doing that with social services savings or economic development in a rural region of the state that might not have taken place? Those are very, very intangible type measures to associate with it, and it's very difficult to come up with cause and effect, but there probably is some of it there, but you can't fully assess it. So I guess if we are committed to delivery of educational services in different areas of the state, numbers don't mean a lot. If numbers meant something, probably in a state of 550,000 people, one university would have sufficed. That was established here in 1917. The plant could have been developed more cheaply here than building facilities throughout the state. We could have brought people to Fairbanks on a continuing basis. The state chose not to do that for some time back and chose to diversify or distribute its educational services around the state in a much broader way. So if your numbers work only if you want to stay in a single campus type situation, which we clearly chose not to do.
What do you think about that decision? Good one, bad one in the long run?
I think at some point, this probably goes back to the first campus operations outside of Fairbanks were established in 1954 in Anchorage and Ketchikan, and then they grew and developed since then. If we wanted the strongest state university that we probably could have, we wouldn't have done that. Distribution of services around the state probably cost something in terms of development of a strong quality institution at a more rapid rate than we have been able to develop it. On the other hand, you trade that off with the fact that boy, southeastern Alaska is a long ways away from Fairbanks, Alaska, and transportation back in the mid-50s was not as easy as it was today, and certainly not an unreasonable decision to try to provide some of those services. Anchorage in 1954 was a growing major metropolitan area. How can you neglect it by not having some form of higher education services? I think what I would fault in retrospect is that it was done in 1954 and then all of the subsequent years where we established campuses throughout the state without any overall thought or plan for how, why, and where we should be delivering educational services. So the board at that time really should have come to grips much more with, what are we going to deliver? Are we going to deliver extension services in some areas only? Are we going to deliver first-year courses in some areas only, second-year courses in some areas only, bachelor's programs, graduate programs? What are we going to do with that? And clearly that wasn't done. And so we had a system that grew beginning in 1954, helter-skelter, all throughout the state, depending on, frankly, to some extent, whims of legislators who were in particularly powerful places at one time or another, or communities who believed because the state was going to pay for higher education in one area, why not have it here as well? And many of those communities viewed higher education more from the economic impact it would have upon their communities than from the educational services. But if you're not paying for it and community X has it, why shouldn't community Y? And so I think there was a lot of that that went on as well. So I think there was a need, I guess, in terms of distributing the services, but it should have been done in a much more planned and cohesive fashion than we did it.
You're listening to Conversations. My guest today is Chancellor Pat O'Rourke. Mr. O'Rourke was born in Astoria, New York, has been in Alaska, as he said, since 1964. He took his doctorate from the University of Connecticut. It is in education, and that was in 1977. Did upper graduate work at Indiana State University, also at St. John's University, and took his bachelor's in psychology and English in 1964 at St. John's University in Jamaica, New York. Dr. Pat O'Rourke on Conversations today. You've worked with, lived with several governors since you've been chancellor of UAF. Do you have a way to gauge the commitment of the most powerful administration in the state to education?
The most powerful administration in the state, the
Do you have a way to gauge the state government's commitment to education?
Sure, reasonable support, I suppose, is perhaps the best gauge, and that's been highly variable over the course of years.
How do you rank it now? What do you think the current administration's commitment to education is?
The current administration has spoken very positively on behalf of higher education in the state. The recent appointments to the Board of Regents have been, in my opinion, very excellent individuals whom I think can contribute a great deal, and that speaks well for the thought and care that went into those appointments. But the first real test of the current administration is coming up, and that test is what will Governor Hickel do with the University of Alaska system's budget as it reaches him. As it came out of the legislature, there was a little bit of flexibility provided to the university in terms of some increased dollars over last year, not a great amount. The governor's Office of Management and Budget has developed some major scenarios for major reductions to that budget. Will the governor respond to the university and higher education needs, or will the governor respond to the Office of Management and Budget and the budget cutting mentality that tends to be much more across the board than any thought out type of action? So I think the governor has his first major test before him. He has spoken very positively and highly of the university. He has spoken of wanting to help us be the nation's institution of the North, and I think he means that. What he needs to understand is that we're not at a position to be able to take major budget reductions and achieve that type of goal. There is some reasonable financing that will be necessary. So the rhetoric has been really good. The actions are about to come upon us, and we shall see over the next couple of weeks how that really falls out. In terms of comparisons of this administration and prior administrations, I suppose one of the things that I find most frustrating when a new administration takes office, and it makes no difference whether it's a Republican or a Alaska Independence Party or a Democratic administration, the approach is always the same. We're going to cut state spending, but the proposals that emerge are proposals that call for cutting across the board, 10% all state agency budgets, rather than a careful look at what is the state of Alaska by its constitution required to provide to the people of Alaska. What services are we providing that the state is funding that we are not required to provide, that are nice-to-have types of functions? What should local government be providing that the state is providing at the present time? What should private business and industry be providing that the state is providing at the present time? And so, unfortunately, I haven't seen that type of careful look from any of the administrations in the last 10, 12 years that look very closely at how to build the required services of the state of Alaska in a way that all can be proud of them but still save the state money by reducing in those areas that the state is funding that it ought not be funding.
Do you think you've twice mentioned the lack of a plan, one in building the statewide system since 1954, and now with each administration coming in having good ideas or bad ideas, but no plan necessarily. But does the University of Alaska Fairbanks, say, have a plan for its priority services and, as you call it, its nice-to-have services, or should it if it doesn't?
Yes, it does have a plan for its priority services. I suppose the problem we have with implementing it is how does it fit into a broader picture that the state might have? Some services that we would plan to deliver from here might be similar types of services that the University of Alaska Anchorage or the University of Alaska Southeast is providing. Now, the system, too, has a plan, and we're trying to integrate the campus plans and the system plans much better than they have been done to date. The issues of how many campuses should we have, either here at UAF or throughout the entire university system, is one that I think still arises from time to time. And again, if you want to play the numbers game, it won't work out to have as many campuses as we have. And so there are some political determinations that have to be made regarding the university's level of distributed services that we haven't achieved at the present time. But we set out certainly over this past decade to try to build upon the really strong elements of the University of Alaska Fairbanks. I think this is an excellent science institution. If you are, wherever you are in this country, if you are interested in an education and career in science, the University of Alaska Fairbanks can provide to you a tremendous opportunity that very few states can. We're among the top 100 universities in the country in terms of our research and development. We have a science faculty who is as well-funded on a per capita basis by the National Science Foundation as any science faculty in the country. We're actually number one on a per capita basis, indicating that our faculty are considered very competitive in national circles, yet we're still small enough where you can get a very tailored education, where you can get a very personalized education, and you won't find that in the University of Washington's and the University of Wisconsin-Madison's and the Minnesota Twin Cities and those places, because you're dealing with 40, 50,000 students at each of those campuses as opposed to 7,000 students here in Fairbanks. And so that's a wonderful blend and combination that, that people can have here. We've set out to try to build a much more globally oriented curriculum and student body, a much more internationally focused university. I think we've achieved a number of those. We've set out to make ourselves one of the premier institutions in terms of study of the North, and I think if you take a look at our anthropology and our Northern Studies program and our Arctic Biology program and a number of others, you're going to find that I think we're achieving that quite well. So I think the plans are there. The question is how rapidly can we implement them. To some extent, they're there, but they're on hold. And when you make no progress toward a plan, people begin to question how valid and viable it can be.
Which leads me to another question that's been on my mind. How strong or fragile is this university if we hit another funding crisis? A lot's been built up over the last 10
sure.
years.
It has. I guess I actually think we're in a fairly fragile state, in that we have some signs of erosion creeping in that could cause us great damage down the line if we don't address them. For instance, equipment. That's something you don't necessarily see, but it is really a very, very major part of the university. Computers, if you want to be teaching on state-of-the-art equipment, you're talking about replacements every 4 years or so in terms of the generations of equipment computers that are coming out. We're unable at the present time to replenish our equipment, to replace our equipment on an adequate enough schedule to assure that we don't have a major problem creeping in there. As a matter of fact, I do tend to think we have a major problem in the equipping area. Facilities. A lot of our facilities are old and aging. Many of them are over 30 years of age, and most of them are over 20 years of age. If you just want to compare that with your house and the type of maintenance that you would need to provide to it at that period of time, we have some major problems occurring in that area. And I guess the key issue is we don't have in our operating budget, which we can count on an annual basis, the money for those things. We request it. They're not particularly attractive, I guess, to governors and legislators to fund all the time. And so we have this creeping problem in both equipment and facilities that I think, if it is not addressed, and we have been addressing it, but it needs even more attention than we've been able to give it. If it's not continued to be addressed, 5 years from now, we could have a real critical problem on our hands. By the way, I would say that as I've traveled around the state and looked at state facilities elsewhere, I don't think that's just a university problem. I think most publicly owned facilities are having similar types of problems, and you can't spend $40 million on a new building and then not maintain it, and you'll lose your investment.
But operating budgets have never been as attractive as capital budgets in this state.
No, that's correct.
We like to build. You're listening to Conversations. I'm Susan McInnes. I'm your host for KUAC-FM. And with me today is outgoing Chancellor for the University of Alaska Fairbanks, Patrick O'Rourke. He's been the Chancellor since 1981, leaves this year in 1991. University of Alaska Fairbanks has 9 schools and colleges and research institutes, enrolls roughly 10,000 students a semester, 6,500 of those on the Fairbanks campus. If you had your druthers, I suppose this is a dream question, but would you attempt to see a guaranteed fund for the university, or how would you like to see this state guarantee education for its for its college students, including the maintenance of the facilities in which they learn?
Guaranteed funds are always difficult items to decide to commit to, and as much as I, as a chancellor at this university, would love to see a guaranteed fund, I'm not sure I could recommend it from a standpoint of public policy. I would, by the way, recommend a fund for the K-12 system, because I think that type of that level of basic education is absolutely essential and must be preserved. The prior administration's proposal along those lines was really quite solid. I'm sorry it didn't get the type of support that it did. But I think you saw in the resistance to that the typical type of resistance that comes up any time you're talking about a reserved fund. It requires actually constitutional approval for it. I suppose ideally I would like to see a mix of state commitment to basic services and large private endowment funds for those extra margins of excellence that institutions like ours could use. I think the handwriting is on the wall for all public institutions that we can't just rest on student tuition and state-generated or state revenues for our funds. We're going to have to go more and more to the private sector. And you see many public institutions throughout the country now engaging in multi-year capital fundraising campaigns and the like, and we actually have a campaign that we've planned over the last 2 years and are just initiating in the very quiet stages at the present time. So I guess ideally I would like to see a blend of state support that would have some reasonable increases to deal with inflation and other things on a periodic basis, something that would take into account the items as facilities and equipment, which aren't always as attractive as a new program or a new building or something like that, connected with reasonable tuitions and fee charges to our students and public, and then I suppose a growing endowment from private funds and a growing altruism within the state and recognition by our alumni, by our supporters, by our businesses that we do business with, that this is a good investment for some of their discretionary funds.
Do you have high hopes?
I have high hopes, yeah, I do. Mm-hmm. And I think what we do here at UAF in this first ever capital fundraising campaign will probably provide a base for the University of Alaska Anchorage and the University of Alaska Southeast to follow as well, and so that they'll have some offshoot benefits from this too.
I want to turn to academics. The University of Alaska has an open admissions system that essentially means you all come.
Right.
this is your
right.
school. We want right. you to come here. What tends to happen, and I think the dilemma that people perceive, is that students who are inadequately prepared for college join in at the same institution with students who are typically thought of as honors students with great potential and great preparation. Do you see this as a dilemma, or do you see it as the status quo that is coped with well?
I see it as a problem that has to be addressed and is being addressed to some extent, but it's a problem. It's far easier to teach a very homogeneous group. If you want the highest retention rates for your university, make your admissions policies as selective as you possibly can, and you will lose very few students throughout that process. You can just look at the types of institutions throughout the country, highly select institutions like Yale, Dartmouth, Harvard, etc., lose 9% of their students. Highly select liberal arts colleges lose 19% of their students. Highly select state universities lose something in the neighborhood of 27% of their students. And you come all the way down to your more open institutions where you're losing about 40 to 50% of your students. And that's just somewhat the nature of it.
Is that where we are?
Yes, we're right in that middle ground. I think we're around 39 5% at the present time between freshman and sophomore year, where most of the attrition takes place. We have some of the very, very best students in the country who go on to graduate work and professions, really in wonderful places, and they've done extremely well via their education here. On the other hand, we have students who are not particularly well prepared. I was looking at our entry ACT scores for students a couple of years ago. We have a total bimodal distribution in terms of, say, math preparation. We have something like 30% of our students are in the top 5% of math students nationally. 30% are in the lowest group, and where we have the smallest number of students is right in the average range. And so I think that makes for a lot of puts a high demand upon the faculty in terms of how to address those types of problems. You know, we do our own sorting internally and try to bring about some changes that will allow us to teach to different groups in a reasonable fashion. We try to work with the elementary secondary school systems to ultimately get them to increase their level of preparation. Been working with Tanana High School out in Tanana. The superintendent out there, Vince Barry, has been very happy that we changed our admission requirements. And although we are still open, we're now requiring a certain distribution of English, math, social sciences, and the rest, because that allowed him to work with his school board to change their curricular requirements in high school. And so that needs to spread throughout some of our schools much more than it has been. But there are ways that we can bring about improved preparation within our high schools that we're not engaging in at the present time.
Do you also think the institution of the core curriculum assists towards that aim?
I don't think the core curriculum assists in terms of sending a signal to the high schools.
Right, but dealing with this, helping the students as they come in to move through their 4 years here.
I guess my view of the core curriculum, which I'm really happy to see us adopt and implement, is really I think we will provide a much sounder foundation for students in their general university requirements, GERS as they are called in some institutions, or general education requirements, than we had been doing in the past. Students could come in and more or less like a cafeteria, select a couple of social science courses here, a couple over there, and progress through the curriculum. And I think in terms of the development of the core, we said, no, there is a real body of knowledge here that all students, regardless of whether they're going to be engineers or business majors or liberal arts majors or scientists, ought to have. And so we have tried to define that as a faculty as best we are able, and I'm pleased with the product that we've come up with. But I think what we will send out of the University of Alaska Fairbanks as a result of the core is a student who is much better prepared to deal with the 21st century and some of the global geography that we're going to be facing in that century.
I want you to take a look with me for a minute at faculty. There was great concern, especially during the major budget cuts, about a brain drain from this institution. Has it been clipped? Is it still going on from your perspective, or is it being turned around?
I don't think the brain drain has been clipped. I think we're still kind of hanging on. In, say, our School of Management, we're still running probably something in the neighborhood of a 20 to 25% attrition rate per year. You know, it's a turnover every 5 years. Then that's not particularly good. But it feels like engineering and management, computer science, and some of the sciences, and even certain fields of English such as rhetoric, are in very, very high demand out there. And what we're finding, of course, with young faculty who haven't yet made their full commitment to the institution, is that there are a lot of competitive offers out there that are much better than what we can offer internally, and so we're still hurting a bit in that area. We haven't clipped it. We're trying to deter it as best we can, but I fear that we may be losing ground a little bit each year.
A stronger place because of the ability to attract money is the research arm of this university. Mm-hmm. For the most part, it seems to be something that goes on quietly. We are known internationally as a research institute, or as a number of research institutes, but it's not necessarily what you first think of when you think of UAF. Can you, say, take a look at what the potential, for example, for the Center for Global Change is at this university? Pick out one of the research projects for me.
You know, interestingly enough, an institute within a university was an attempt to bring more than one discipline together to study problems. And so you have a geophysical institute, and the Institute of Arctic Biology should draw upon biologists and chemists and ecologists and the rest to explore certain problems there. And the same thing with each of our institutes. What's happened over the past 25 years is that science has become far more interdisciplinary than even our institutes are able to accomplish. That's really, I suppose, what led to the development of the Center for Global Change and Earth System Science, which we established 2 years ago. This center, certainly from an administrative standpoint or physical standpoint, is very, very slim and should always be very slim. What we want it to be is a protagonist force to force more of the interdisciplinary approach to scientific problems than we're able to do through our institutes at the present time. The whole issue of global change itself is one that we're going to hear a lot about for the next 20 years. People believe that the first and most dramatic signs of any change in our planet will be seen in the north because of our fragility and ability to notice and detect changes more rapidly than will happen in more temperate climates. President Bush has recommended $1.3 billion of research funding for global change across seven different federal agencies for the next cycle. That's a major commitment in that area. Take that. Take our geographic position, take the high quality of faculty that I think we already have in place, add to it a few facilities that we don't have, mm-hmm. some major equipment and graduate assistance support, which we don't have, and all of which should come from the state, and we could be this nation's leader in the study of global change. I really think that that's possible. To make it happen, I think we're going to have to see some expansion of facilities, equipment, and graduate student support from the state, in addition to all of the external funds that our faculty do generate and can generate from the federal government. There's a great future there for us to take a major leading role in this country.
Are there other areas or disciplines, or is there other work going on in this campus where you believe that we're on the leading edge?
Sure, marine science, and we shouldn't forget that particular one. In that area, we're very, very competitive. I mean, we have over 50% of the coastline of the United States. We have a very, very strong faculty. Our ability to attract and draw scientific dollars is there. Again, we're limited by physical space, laboratory space to a very large extent. But we see whenever we go out to recruit for faculty in those areas, in some ways we have an easier time recruiting, at least at the front end, because they are already familiar with our reputation and would like to be part of the organization. We have a more difficult time because we're unable to provide the type of graduate students and facility support that other institutions can as well. But that's another area. I think our whole northern social science effort is a growing one. Some years ago, the University of Wisconsin-Madison was viewed as the strong program in northern anthropology. I really think we have usurped Wisconsin today, and that we hold that position at the present time. I think you see in the School of Management and its professional school accreditation a small but very strong school. Our students have been fourth in the country in terms of AT&T stock market simulation. Our mm-hmm. students have been first in the country in the national marketing examination, and so we see that coming. 2 years in a row now, our mathematics students have won the applied mathematics competition in the nation, and that doesn't happen without strong departments backing up those student efforts. And so I see it in a number of areas that people aren't always as aware of as they might be.
Let's take a look at some general education issues for a while during this discussion. Let me remind folks you're listening to Conversations. Today we're having a discussion with Chancellor Pat O'Rourke. He has been with the University of Alaska Fairbanks since 1981, resigns this year to go on to other things, and has been in the state teaching or working within a university system since 1964. My understanding is that some 20% of our population nationwide has a baccalaureate degree. 3% have graduate degrees. Do you think that these are reasonable numbers for our population? Do you think we fall below where we need to be in 1991?
We're still the most educated country in the world with those figures, and recognize that those figures take in people who are 70 years of age today and grew up at a very different time educationally than what we have today. Add to those numbers the fact that 56% of all high school graduates are entering college and universities, and so I think you're going to see those numbers become much larger over the next two decades than they are today. You're going to see a lot higher completion rate. Will they be adequate for the next century?
Add to this another question, if you can blend in a second one. There's a lot of criticism of American students these days that they don't write well enough, they don't read well enough, their math isn't good, their science isn't good. I mean, across the board,
sure,
we've been criticized and criticizing our youngsters.
Right. And I think we're trying to address that in our elementary and secondary schools, at least to some extent. It'll be a bit before we see the results begin to play. You know, I recognize that I come from the higher education and post-secondary education sector, but I think while there is appropriate criticism to be addressed at our sector, I think some of the deficiencies of elementary and secondary schools are overcome in our colleges and universities. I remember about 4 years ago, I was sitting one Sunday morning in the office of the president of Tohoku National University in Japan, one of the fine national universities there. And he very excitedly said to me, he said, "Why is it that our students leave secondary school ahead of your American students, and by the time our students enter graduate school, your American students have already surpassed us again. Why is that, Chancellor?" And this was from a colleague and clearly a competitor who was very proud of where their students were. And I think partially it's because we do a number of things in our system. We encourage discussion and debate. We encourage students to challenge the thinking of a teacher. That's not done in the Far East. It's all quite rote. We also have a lot of hands-on types of experiences. We're very laboratory-oriented. We won't just read about it in a textbook. We'll go into a lab and actually work through it. You don't find that to the same level in many other educational systems throughout the country. And so I would like to think that we overcome those deficiencies by the time our students complete the bachelor's level of education, and then at the graduate level, they compete probably better than any in the world at the present time. Again, nationally, I think all of this is at risk. 56% of all engineering doctorates today go to non-American, from American universities, go to foreign nationals. Something like 32% of all physical science degrees are going to foreign nationals from American universities, PhD degrees, and they're the future academia of tomorrow.
That very much looks like students from around the world are taking advantage of our system, but students within the system aren't taking advantage of the system.
Right. We still, in math, science, engineering, we're still not finding a sufficient flow of American students into those fields, and that's where I think the real danger lies. And I think if this pattern continues nationally, we're in danger of losing our technological edge, and if we lose our technological edge, we're certainly going to lose our economic edge in this world. There are a number of countries thundering down on us, and it's a major problem. It's an early erosion. Even if we began now in terms of doubling the numbers, I think we still might be at risk. So to some extent, I guess back to your original question, it's maybe not so much the numbers, the 21% of students of Americans who hold at least a baccalaureate degree, but it's maybe more some of the fields that students are going into, and we still have an inadequate number of American students entering fields of math, science, engineering, and the like.
Where you think it's going to be in the next 20 years, yeah.
Sure.
What do you think quality education means in 1991? If a student were coming into your university and said, Dr. O'Rourke, what should I know when I come out again in 1995 or further if that person goes for a graduate degree?
What should I know? Wow. I'm not sure I'm capable of answering everything that a student should know. But a student should know how to read the signs out there in the world in terms of what is happening. Should know how to access information that might assist him or her in terms of understanding and interpreting those signs, and ought to know how to raise questions, integrate that information with the observations that have been made, and formulate questions that will lead to further quest for information. And I guess if we do that with our students, we're really going to prepare them to be able to be continuing learners throughout their lives, and we need to teach them to integrate those things. We've been great as Americans at analyzing information and data. I think a piece that we need to improve upon is synthesizing things. How do we, okay, we have all of these facts. Now, how can we put all of that together to address a much broader problem? We're not just talking about an economic problem in an area. We might be talking about social problems that flow from that deficient economy. We may be talking about educational problems in the schools because an inadequate job is being done. And so we need to somehow take all of these things and do a much better job of synthesis than we might. I'm sorry, I might have gotten away from your question.
No, I don't think so. The answer seems to be, if I can sum it quickly, to learn to learn and to learn to synthesize what you learn, which tells me that you think this world is going to change very fast over the next 20 or 30 years.
Sure, I mean.
And continually.
I mean, think of where we grew up. When I was born, jet planes didn't exist. When my father was born, planes didn't exist. When my children were born, we were shooting rockets into space. What about when their children are born?
This brings me to my final set of questions. When you spoke to the graduating and other students and faculty at this year's commencement, you focused on the subject of leadership. Do you think that is a quality lacking, or is it a quality that many more people must exert on an individual level? Why did you pick that for your subject?
I chose it as a topic to talk to the graduates about for a couple of reasons. One, I believe because of their education, they will be in a position to lead more often than will others in our society. And they will be called upon to lead more often than others in our society. And that they ought to know some things about it. I suppose the other reason I chose it is because I sometimes think that the right elements of leadership are not looked to. I think where we fail in leadership in our society is that we don't encourage our leaders to take risks. Consider who wins a presidential election. The more you narrow the differences between yourself and the opposing candidate, the better your chances are. The less you go out on the extremes at either end in terms of your position, the better your chances are. You have any number of candidates who have entered early primaries. You had Bruce Babbitt from Arizona, a fine governor in Arizona, who entered the primaries 6 years ago. How far did he get? He got 2% of the vote. He had a plan laid out. He understood the finances of the country. He did propose some budget reductions and a variety of other things. He had very concrete plans for what ought to happen. Is he electable? Clearly he wasn't electable. People didn't want to hear the truth to some extent. What kind of message are we sending to people when we do that at the polls? We're basically saying to them, don't take strong positions. Don't take strong stands, because if you do, you're not going to get what you want to achieve out of life. I think the message I was trying to provide to students is take strong stands. You know, you might get hurt along the way, but the integrity that you bring to that is worth far more to you in the long run than whatever else will happen. And so please understand that people might not want you to voice your opinions as educated opinions, but my message was please do take them, because we need that. We need a lot more of that. We need people who are going to challenge existing ideas and thought far more than we do. So I guess that's maybe the gap of leadership that I see in this country, is that we're beginning to get too conformist a type of leadership. And, you know, when someone doesn't say to you, I think you're wrong, and if you do that, you're liable to have a big problem on your hands. If we don't have that, if senators and governors and chancellors and presidents don't encourage that with the staff and people with whom they work, we're living in a Pollyannish type of world that has no reality at all and will be ineffective.
Pat O'Rourke, I want to thank you very much for this hour on Conversations. Pat O'Rourke leaves the University of Alaska Fairbanks after serving it since 1981 as its chancellor. He has served the system since 1970 and worked in this state since 1964. Thank you very much for this hour in Conversations.
Well, thanks for the invitation. Glad to be here.
Pleasure. I hope you'll join us again next week.